Please be advised, this episode contains mentions of sexual assault.
From Wondery, I'm Brooke Siffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. And this is Even the Rich.
Okay, so before we start the show, there's something I need to say, and I've been waiting a long time to say it. Happy anniversary, Arisha. This is our 100th episode of Even the Rich.
I know. I'm still pinching myself. I mean, we're finally getting to go into syndication.
I know. It's such an exciting time. Okay, maybe not that, but we do have a bonus episode for our Richies to celebrate hitting the 100 mark. And we're going to answer all of our listeners' burning questions about the show. Like, do we have any juicy celeb gossip from our pre-ETR life as valets? And do we have any celebrities we've covered that have ever gotten in touch with us after listening?
Yeah, one of our favorite stories, actually.
Yes, and you know we love a good story, which takes us to our guest today, author and social scientist Alexandra Stain, who also has a very interesting story to tell. Alexandra has a PhD in the sociology of cults, which she got after surviving 10 years in a cult. She wrote about it in her books Inside Out, a memoir of entering into and breaking out of a Minneapolis political cult, and more recently, Terror, Love, and Brainwashing.
Yeah, and if you're like me, you probably wondered why Patty Hearst stayed with the SLA even when she had a chance to escape. Alexandra will help us understand why leaving a cult can be so incredibly hard. And she's also going to break down the basic steps cult leaders use to brainwash their subjects.
Alexandra Stain, we are so excited to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
So I want to ask you about your time with the political cult, the O. But first, can you tell us the story of when you first heard about the SLA? Where were you and what do you remember about it?
Well, I was in Berkeley at the time. I think I was about 18, 19 years old. I'd moved to California from London. Mm-hmm. My boyfriend and I mostly thought it was, I suppose, in a way, we thought it was kind of funny. Or, I mean, not funny, ha-ha, but funny. Yeah. Look at these weird people. And we had one of their kind of newspaper big ads that they'd made posted on our wall. But we were, yeah, pretty ironic about the whole thing.
I love that. So can you just remind us what the political climate was like at the time? So to remind everyone, we're talking San Francisco, Berkeley area in the early 70s, which I can only assume is a crazy time to be in the Bay Area.
Well, it was kind of a wonderful time in a lot of ways. I mean, the Vietnam War was just coming to an end, I believe. And, you know, it was an absolute hub of political activism. You know, people were sort of working together in a lot of ways. But it was also, I think it was the Kent State shootings. You know, that was where young demonstrators were shot by the National Guard. But people were very active and angry, but also trying to build positive things, but also very aware of that the state could come after them, sometimes with fatal consequences.
You know, in putting this series together, it sounded like even among the left, the SLA was like a parody of leftist politics. So I'm wondering, what was your take on their message? What were their flyers and their newspaper ads actually preaching?
I don't think we really took that seriously. I mean, they were sort of supposedly, you know, about some kind of liberation. And they seemed, I suppose you call them today, extremists. You know, I think we kind of could tell it almost. It was a bit of a, I don't think we would have used these words, but a bit cultic.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of us, myself included, hear about cults and extreme radical groups and think, how could anyone buy what they're selling? So I'm curious, when you first heard about the SLA, did the idea of joining that kind of group sound even a little bit appealing at all?
No. Myself and my friends back at that time saw ourselves as, I mean, in a very idealistic manner that, you know, now I look back and think, well, we were a bit naive, weren't we? but we wanted, you know, we wanted a change of government. We wanted an end to the war. We wanted social justice and more equality and an end to the total power of the big corporations. You know, we wanted all those things. So that's kind of how we saw, we didn't see, I don't think, this little group that was going around doing crazy things. I don't think that was in our mind. Mm-hmm. That was a reasonable mm-hmm. thing to do.
Yeah. So then I'm curious, at the time, did you follow Patty Hearst's involvement with the SLA, the kidnapping and the bank robberies?
You couldn't avoid it. It was the big news. You know, you'd have to have been blind and deaf and
living under a rock.
Hey, yeah.
Living under a rock is a better way to put that.
So let's talk about the O, which was the underground group that you spent a decade in. Being someone who never thought you would join this sort of group, how did you first hear about the O and what was so enticing about it?
I met some very nice people who were doing union organizing. That was my entry point. The stated goals of the O, which were not in actuality its real goals, but what I thought the goals were indeed, you know, a revolutionary struggle to have a society that wasn't ruled by the ultra rich, but had more equality and sharing of power. But that wasn't, in fact, the goals.
So when people join a group like this, do you think they have any idea that they're maybe going to surrender control of their life for the next decade or who knows how long? Or are they just kind of going in hoping for change and not thinking long term?
It's not that they don't think long term. It's that these groups are deceptive. So you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I was willing to accept that my life would change if I was going to be very serious about trying to make social change. You know, like if you decide to go to medical school, you accept that you're going to be, you know, working really long hours, right? You accept that because the goal is what you want. The problem with these kind of groups is the goal that you think it is not the actual goal. I mean, that's a universal with cults, that they lie about what it is that you're going to be doing. So you certainly don't think you're going to have every movement and every thought controlled for the benefit of a psychopath who runs it.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay. Well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh, yeah. The Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen. And you know, I love my thrillers.
I can agree. I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text Even the Rich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text Even the Rich to 500-500 to get started. So Patty's story was a little bit different. She was obviously kidnapped and, you know, put in a closet. But a lot of members of groups like this choose to join. Can you just talk to us a little bit about some of the recruitment and grooming techniques that these groups use?
Well, first of all, you know, in my book, I talk about people come into these groups in different ways and they leave in different ways. Mm-hmm. What's common is the experience when you're in it. That's the, in a way, the most interesting thing is what's happening when you're in it. The ways people get into these groups may be like Patty Hearst being kidnapped. And we see that a lot. That's not that's rare in North America, but it's not rare, for instance, in Uganda with the child soldiers into what are basically cults.
Yeah, right.
So the kidnapping or press ganging is one way. Another way is the way I got in, being recruited. Another way is being born or brought up in these cults, being brought in by your parents. And that's a whole different story, a really important story, I want to add, because there's many hundreds of thousands of people where that's their story, and that doesn't get told enough.
Right.
In the kind of stereotypical recruitment, which is, I really emphasize, not the only way, maybe not even the most frequent way, if you're looking globally at these things.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get told you're getting one thing. You know, if you come to, you know, this meeting, you know, you're going to study some useful information that's going to help you understand how to make social change and fight for the rights of the oppressed. In the case of a political group, of course, there's yoga groups, there's religious groups, there's any kind of group, and they're going to have a different story. You know, come and do yoga with us and, you know, you're going to have more wellness. You know, it depends entirely on the group. But you'll have a story that is appealing to you at that time in your life. And also you may be in a position where you're in between things. That's fairly common, where you're in a normal life change. You know, you've broken up with an important relationship, you know, moved states, you've left university, you've changed jobs. You know, you're looking for something new in a normal way. You're not looking to be controlled. You're not needy. You're not seeking domination. You're just looking for something in a normal way. And if you're unlucky, you're going to come across something that's exploitative. So, you know, there's a come on, a story that fits where you might, your interests might lie. And then it kind of ramps up. You know, you might go to one meeting and then they might start saying, well, you know, come to this demonstration on the weekend. And then they might say, we really need to study a little bit more, come to two or three meetings a week. And, oh, by the way, there's a room empty at this household and it'd be great if you moved in. And are you really committed to social justice? You know, if you are, you should really come and work in our bookstore. Mm-hmm. You know, it slowly you get what I call engulfed in the system. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you get isolated from your prior personal network. That's really the key to this, how this works. And then once they've succeeded at that, they can then start what I call, you know, inducing feelings of stress, threat, or fear through a variety, again, depending on the group, through a variety of measures. In my group, it was a lot of exhaustion and criticism. I think for Paddy Hurst, it was being locked in a closet.
Yeah.
At the same time, being cut off from anyone, obviously she was. And also at the same time, being told that these people were the good people. They were doing good for humanity. So in a cult, you have to have that combination of isolation, of engulfment, and then the system in which you're in presenting itself as the good place, while at the same time, it's actually the source of stress or fear. And it creates a form of what we can think of as a Stockholm syndrome, where you have nowhere else to turn to try to feel better. And so you turn to who's there, the only people who are there are the group. And that's a very, very powerful dynamic. And it's actually very similar, if not almost exactly the same, as we see in domestic abuse, controlling domestic abuse, like, you know, a battering boyfriend who switches from charming to frightening in the blink of an eye. These are powerful dynamics that work very well on nearly all human beings, unless they are educated prior to exposure to this and know and understand how these techniques work. And that's protective. Now, myself nor Paddy Hurst had any prior understanding of that, and that makes you vulnerable to those dynamics of coercive control is one of the words. You can also call it brainwashing or indoctrination.
So isolation and trust seem to be like big parts of this, as you just kind of explained. And in Patty's story, there were moments when the public turned on her, like after the first bank robbery, or even before that when her father wasn't meeting the SLA's demands. And it really seemed to rattle her, leaving her questioning who she could put her faith in, And I'm wondering if that's something that cult leaders really try to tap into.
Well, they try to tell you that the outside world is bad and is against mm-hmm. you and is evil. So, you know, this is why it's very difficult to talk to someone in a cult. You have to be careful because if you confront them too directly, they can experience that as, oh, you know, our cult leader told us you would, you know, be aggressive with us or confronting. You must be bad. You know, it's better to try to form a kind of emotional trusting bond if possible. So yeah, that's they put a lot of energy, cults, into saying the outside world is bad. So, you know, in a lot of Christian religious cults, the outside world are called worldly. The children of God, they were called systemites. You know, there's usually a name for the, well, I've just talked to somebody who's in an acting cult, and they had this funny kind of word, which I won't say the exact word because I don't want to identify them, but it's sort of like smiggles, you know. There's always a way of trying to say it's a kind of creating an us versus them dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure Patty Hearst, you know, they would have been saying, look, something like your father is evil, you know, or he's not trying hard enough to save you. He doesn't care about you. You know, your family hasn't answered our letters. They, you know, I don't know exactly what they said, but they would have been pouring this stuff into her ears, and she would have had no other information. Right. So, you know, you have the single source of information is the cult. You have no way of validating the reality. And when you're frightened, which you are in cults, and obviously she was, you know, our brains don't work very well when we're in a state of chronic fear or trauma. It's just mm-hmm. a biological fact that our brains tend to dissociate in mm-hmm. that situation. We can't think clearly about what's happening to us. And when you can't think clearly about what's happening to you, the cult can tell you what to think. And that's really the essence of how brainwashing works.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with Patty's story, she said she began to almost fear the FBI more than the SLA, because they told her, you know, the FBI will shoot you the second they see you. So I'm assuming that's very similar to what you're talking about, to create fear. And that seems like a common technique, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, you can see from her point of view, that would have felt plausible. And by the way, the FBI was shooting people.
Yeah.
So that would have felt plausible to her. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
So in her book, Patty writes about how even though she was kidnapped and traumatized, she took a certain amount of comfort in how regimented SLA life was. It was like, you know, she didn't have to think or worry about what was happening to her. She could kind of just follow the rules. Is this something that you can relate to in your experience? Is this something a lot of people who join these groups can relate to?
I think they can. I don't think that's always the case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not much of a rule follower, you know, by nature. And I was like that before the cult as well. You know, I'm a bit feisty, you know, from a feisty, non-rule following family. I think I more was like, well, this is what the revolution needs. It was mm-hmm. more a kind of cognitive thing. For her, you know, I don't know what her life was like before, but in the context of the chaos of being kidnapped, et cetera, and not knowing, you know, I'm going back to the closet and the blindfold, you know, she was in there for quite a while, I seem to remember. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that after you get out of that, then, you know, a steady life probably seems like a good thing. So you have to see these things in the context in which they were.
So one of the things that's hard for, I think, some people to get their head around is how someone can feel so powerless to leave a cult, even when they're having serious doubts. And I'm wondering if that happens where people try to leave, but they're unable to actually get out, or they come back.
Yeah, there's a very, in my field, a well-known concept called cult hopping.
Oh,
Someone might leave a cult because something in particular happens. But then if they haven't understood what a cult is, and if they haven't understood those dynamics that I was talking about previously, and also they may not have anything to land into, you know, because say if you've been a cult, as I was for 10 years, and I was very far from my previous friends and family, you know, think about how things change in a decade.
Right.
And all your close connections have been in the group. And maybe your work is in the group. Maybe your housing is in the group. Mm-hmm. And you leave. Where do you go? Now we have battered women's shelters and refuges. Yeah. Not enough, but we have them. There's nothing like that for people coming right. from the cults. So you come out into this world that you can barely speak the language of anymore, because the nature of that bubble that you've been living in is quite extreme. You know, cults have their own special language and ways of doing things, and you come out back into the real world. It's very difficult. It's very confusing. And if you don't know that it was a cult, your head is just maybe spinning for a while, and you may, you know, just again go to something else because you haven't been lucky enough to have that explained to you. I mean, I was lucky. I consider myself very lucky because I discovered the cult analysis and some of the literature just 3 months after I got out through a little tiny in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that talked about cult mind control, free minds. There was a phone number. This was all before the internet. And I was able to call that, and they sent me a package of information. Mostly, I remember, with Robert J. Lifton's 8 criteria of brainwashing. And he actually talked to Patty Hearst after she got out, helping her understand her experience. And he's one of the foundational scholars in our field. And when I saw that list of 8 criteria, I could go, wow, yeah, this was a cult. I mean, now we think about political cults because we've got QAnon and we've got all these crazy right-wing extremists. And there are still some left-wing cults, though fewer than the right-wing ones at this point. But back then, when you said cult, you thought religious cult.
Right.
So it was quite a leap. And again, I was very lucky to find that literature and be able to quite quickly go, oh, hell, that's what happened to me.
Yeah.
And that was marvelously empowering. That's why I do the work I do today, because I know how healing it is for people who come out of cults to have a framework to understand their experience, that they weren't stupid, they weren't horrible, they weren't needy, they had bad luck, and they had no prior education to protect them. So that's one reason people go back in.
So before you left the O for good, did you ever have that experience of trying to leave and then going back?
When I left my group after a year, because they were treating the non-cult workers so badly and there were some other things going on, I was totally isolated when I got out. I knew nobody in Minneapolis. I didn't know what this group was. My cult husband wasn't allowed to talk to me.
Oh.
I basically sat in a horrid little apartment in Minneapolis on my own for 3 months and then went back, because where else was I going to go, in a way?
Right, right.
And also, cults make you keep secrets, which again, if you think about, well, like child sexual abuse, that's often a feature, isn't it? Don't tell anyone.
Right.
And cults, nearly all cults do a version of that. There's some important reason you mustn't tell. So you're kind of silent, you're on your own, you have no analytical framework, you have no resources. It's easier to go back, unless you're able to reestablish a network of support and resources and so forth. If I can just say one other really important thing about why it's so hard to get out.
Sure.
Is because, I mean, people in cults are not happy people, even if they've got the fake smile on
them, which some
of the happy clappy cults do. Ours didn't need fake smiles. We were very grim. But because of that dynamic of we're the good people, but we're frightening you, and that creates this trauma relationship, it's actually frightening to think about the relationship. Now, if you're able to get out despite that, you have a lot of fear when you get out. You're frightened the cult's going to come after you and do something to you and possibly kill you. Yeah, you just feel that, is all I can say. Or they're going to in some way come after you and punish you. You're frightened about how you're going to survive, the practical details of life. But you also have this kind of existential fear. Like, I always describe it as you feel like you're walking off the edge of the planet into a void, dropping off the edge of a planet, and you don't know where you're going to land. And that's not a rational feeling. That's like an emotional, physiological fear. That's the fear you've been carrying around that whole time in that chronic relational trauma. It's what I call a nameless fear. And it takes a lot of guts to push through that, to have faith that when you get out, you will land somewhere.
Yeah.
You won't disappear into the blackness of the universe. And that's simply a kind of physiological and psychological result of brainwashing. But it's very real to the person leaving.
Right.
And that's also, and that's what can keep people in. Though they couldn't, it's not like they could express that when they're in. That's only when you're out.
Yeah. I think that really explains, you know, there's a moment where Patty Hearst is in a car by herself and the two members she's with are caught shoplifting and they're being held down by police. And I know our minds were like, well, why doesn't she run? Why doesn't she leave? And I think that really explains why she didn't and why she stuck around and did the things she did. So that makes it very clear now to me.
And one of the things that surprised me was that there are people who don't believe brainwashing is something that can actually happen. And I'm wondering, Alex, what is your take on that debate over whether Patty was brainwashed or whether to some degree she voluntarily participated in the SLA's plots?
Well, first of all, I would say, what's voluntary about being kidnapped, locked in a closet, blindfolded, and raped? None of that is voluntary. So
right.
The starting point is a pretty weak for that argument.
Sure.
And then I would say that people with more experience than me, and I've had a lot of experience at this point and studies, you know, in this field, namely Margaret Singer, who's a great scholar and practitioner in cultic studies, and Robert J. Lifton, equally, both of whom in the 50s were sent to Korea to study by the U.S. Army, who do, by the way, believe there's such a thing as brainwashing. They were sent there to study people who had come out of the Chinese and North Korean prisoner of war and re-education camps. And that was really where the whole concept of brainwashing was developed, was those two army psychiatrists is what they were, where they saw these, not only Westerners, but mostly Westerners who had come out of these very difficult experiences. Some of them saying, oh, you know, Mao Zedong is the greatest thing since sliced bread and, you know, it's all wonderful. And then over a period of time, they kind of, so to speak, came back to themselves. They'd had these personality changes, or I should say thought changes, thought reform. So those two scholars and practitioners, Margaret Singer, Robert J. Lifton, both independently worked with Patty Hearst and said she was brainwashed. So, you know, you have the people at the foundation of this concept who directly worked with her saying this. So, you know, that's good enough for me. Yeah, along with this ridiculous idea that someone who's been through what she went through would be doing it voluntarily. It just doesn't make, it's not even common sense, let alone academic sense.
When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals more easily and still have the occasional treat.
Exactly. And Chime's here to help you do that. With a Chime checking account, you can make financial progress with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit.
Yep. So if you set up direct deposit into your Chime account and use an activated debit card, Chime will spot you up to your limit when you exceed your balance.
And I love that Chime never charges fees or interest for using SpotMe. To date, Chime has spotted members over $20 billion.
Oh my God. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/rich. That's chime.com/rich.
Chime feels like progress.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency, and in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10, to get your Magnesium Breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10.
So Patty Hearst's journey out of the SLA ended to some extent with her arrest and prison sentence. Of course, she was ultimately pardoned, went on to have 2 children. She has a film career, and she was able to put this chapter of her life behind her. But I'm wondering, what do you think it was that helped her move on from the SLA and break free from that radicalized mindset?
Well, I talk quite a lot in my book about both recovery and also, yeah, just how people get out. Mm-hmm. And also what helped me is one of the things, it's not always the case, but I think more often than not, people have what I call an escape hatch attachment relationship. So in other words, the cult has sort of coerced you into feeling attached to them as mm-hmm. this kind of fake safe place. And it often that bond, that kind of maladaptive bond, can be broken if you have an alternate and real safe place or safe yeah. attachment. You know, in my case, it was another woman in the cult, and we started confiding in each other. There were other things that helped me get out, but that was one of the things. And in her case, you know, I understand she married one of her bodyguards, who I think had been her bodyguard when she was on bail. So it seemed mm-hmm. really she would have formed a trusting relationship. And that trusting relationship doesn't have to be someone who tells you that's a cult. It's just you are free to do your own thinking, because these untrusting cults don't want you to think it through, right? So they're always right. telling you what to think, and that's never about the reality of what you're experiencing. But yeah. if you're in a truly safe relationship, you can reflect on, you know, oh, this is actually safe. I'm not frightened with this person. And then you can think back to your experience, and it helps you reintegrate that dissociated mind that brainwashing causes. So there are other ways to get there, but I think a lot having that other safe, the escape hatch attachment is key. And I believe yeah. she had that. Then in terms of kind of more longer term recovery, I think it's very interesting that she did write that book. You know, she got some professional help from someone who understood cults. But part of the recovery process, if you think of the dissociated brain as split in two, where you can't think about your feelings, which is what happens in trauma. And the cult, therefore, can think about your feelings for you and tell you what you're feeling, right? So when you need to reintegrate your brain, you have to review that experience and now do your own thinking about what you were feeling during that time. And that is a language-based process, generally speaking. So when I got out, I wrote my first book. I just had this drive. It was a kind of unstoppable drive to write what had actually happened. And that's my memoir, Inside Out, where I was like, I've got to tell the story. I have to understand it for myself. I have to tell the truth about what happened. And then in the back of my mind was also, and this might be helpful to someone else down the line. So often writing or talking through, you know, telling a narrative about what happened to you is very important for reintegrating your thinking in a good way, in a healthy and strong way.
Alexandra, this was very fascinating. It was a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Alex.
You're welcome.
To learn more about Alexandra's story, check out Inside Out, a memoir of entering into and breaking out of a Minneapolis political cult, and Terror, Love, and Brainwashing by Alexandra Stain herself.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Even the Rich ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Brooke Sifrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. This episode was produced by Peter Arcuni with additional production by Haley Gray. Our series producer is Kate Young. Natalie Shisha is our senior producer. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.